This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
By the time we come to the spring of 1844, there is a general hatred on the part of the people in Hancock County, especially against Joseph Smith and other church leaders.
Coming up next, The Climax of Nauvoo, Part 1.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
In Nauvoo's early years, the Latter-day Saints enjoyed both temporal and spiritual prosperity. But while Mormonism grew, especially in Illinois, the skeptical eyes of their neighbors were turned upon them. Now, Joseph Smith's difficulties with the law were the most visible, but there were other sources of discord that were growing all the while beneath the surface.
Kenneth W. Godfrey.
Now, there were two major cities in Hancock County at the time that the Mormons arrived and settled in Nauvoo. There was the county seat, which was Carthage. There was also the community of Warsaw, which had about 800 inhabitants in 1839. And it was also a city that was had great promise in the eyes of its founders and the citizenry. They were right on where the Des Moines River enters the Mississippi, and they thought they could become a great commercial center that would perhaps rival or outdistance Chicago. Well, when the Latter-day Saints began to gather at Nauvoo, and as the population of Nauvoo exploded, there were great concerns raised on the part of the citizenry of Warsaw that they were being left out and would soon be dwarfed. In fact, if you look at a map of Hancock County, there are a host of little cities besides Nauvoo and Carthage and Warsaw. And there are about 2,300 Latter-day Saints by 1844 and 45 that are have their homes in these little communities. Well, there were some citizens of Warsaw, including Thomas Sharp, who saw this as an attempt on the part of the Latter-day Saints to surround them.
Warsaw, Illinois, is about 15 miles downriver from Nauvoo. In 1840, a young man, 22 years of age, Thomas Sharp, settled there, and he became a newspaperman. Now, initially, Sharp had no agenda with the Mormons, but as time went on, he became the most formidable voice against Joseph Smith and the Latter-day Saints.
He established a paper, the Warsaw Signal, and in this newspaper, he was at first fairly complimentary towards the Latter-day Saints. If you read the articles, they're fairly balanced and not all that anti-Mormon. In fact, they're not anti-Mormon at all. Sharp was also invited to come to Nauvoo for the laying of the cornerstones of the Nauvoo Temple. And this event was a great public affair in Nauvoo. The Nauvoo Legion was mustered. He was treated very well, and there are some authorities that think that seeing the Nauvoo Legion and looking at the military activities of that day caused Thomas Sharp some concern, which were at the roots of, or he's began some of his anti-Mormon feeling at this point in his life.
Then finally, Thomas Sharp wrote an editorial that was viewed by some as critical of the church and its practices. Joseph Smith reacted quite strongly to that, and from that point forward, Sharp was an enemy.
So Joseph Smith, on May the 26th, 1841, wrote a letter to Thomas Sharp in which he said, "Mr. Sharp, editor of the Warsaw Signal, sir, you will discontinue my paper. Its contents are calculated to pollute me and to patronize the filthy sheet. That tissue of lies, that sink of iniquity, is disgraceful to any moral man. Yours with utter contempt, Joseph Smith. Please publish the above in your contemptible newspaper and cancel my subscription." Well, following this little exchange, Thomas Sharp turns then on Joseph Smith and the church, and he begins to formulate anti-Mormon feelings and bring others around him, and they feel like they've got to do something with the church.
At the same time that Sharp and his newspaper turned against the Mormons and sought the means to vilify them, Joseph Smith was freed of Missouri's attempts to extradite him by the courts. This didn't help his press coverage.
In the eyes of the non-Mormon population of Hancock County, they're beginning to see Joseph Smith as a man who can circumvent the law, that he's never found guilty. He's always acquitted because he uses his clout and his friends to be set free. And so this is causing some easiness, and Thomas Sharp and others begin to harp away at this.
Not only were the saints' prominence and their prosperity a cause of jealousy and hatred against them, but so too, predictably, was Hancock County politics.
Well, as Nauvoo grew larger, the Latter-day Saints, whoever they viewed as their friends, would usually win the elections in Hancock County. So in 1841, Thomas Sharp and others organized the anti-Mormon party. Now, this was not a party at first that was prone to violence and to other harmful acts on Latter-day Saints. It was a political party in which they gathered together their adherents and said the Mormons seem to vote as a block. That's how they get people elected that are their friends. But if we all vote as a block, we can perhaps win an election or two. And so they tried this out and lost the election of 1841. The Friends of the Latter-day Saints were elected. But as the election of 1842 approached, they consolidated their forces and hoped they would be able to pull off a victory in this election. And but again, the Latter-day Saints won most of the votes in 1842.
Because of the bad behavior of a few Mormons, a serious difficulty arose in Hancock County. The residents of Hancock County, the non-Mormons, came to believe that the Mormons were teaching, believing, and practicing that it was okay to steal from them. Now, Joseph Smith quickly condemned this lawlessness on the part of his people, but it made no difference. Rumor and suspicion prevailed anyway. And thereafter, the non-Mormon residents of Hancock County came to perceive that the Mormons were a threat to their peace and security.
And there was a misconception that all of the crimes in Hancock County were committed by Latter-day Saints. If you review the High Council minutes in Nauvoo, which are available, and the High Council often acted as a court, a review of those minutes discloses that some Mormons were charged with slander, embezzling, theft, adultery, and other crimes. But the church never sanctioned crime, and William Law said there was less crime in Nauvoo than there were in other cities of similar size. But there was still the perception on the part of the populace that Nauvoo harbored thieves and embezzlers, and there was even a rumor that there was a counterfeiting ring operating in Nauvoo. And this was not helped in the town of Ramus, in which there was the arrest of members of the High Council for thievery. They were excommunicated from the church, but in the testimony, when they were arrested for their crimes of thievery by civic authorities, they said that they were told by Joseph Smith it was all right to steal if it was against the Gentiles, and it didn't count against the rules of the church. And this, of course, was false, but this notion also spread among the populace that Joseph Smith was telling people it was okay to steal from non-Mormons.
There were other matters that aroused strong emotions against Joseph Smith. Plural marriage. Early in his ministry, while revising the text of the Bible, Joseph Smith likely received revelation about the restoration of biblical polygamy when it was finally implemented in early Nauvoo. It proved to be an enormous challenge and complicated the remainder of his life.
Now, while all of these things are transpiring, there is a conspiracy that forms within the church as well. Joseph Smith began to teach and practice a plural marriage and encourage some of his followers, a selected group of followers, to practice plural marriage as well.
Ronald K. Esplin.
Well, Latter-day Saints naturally would like to know what Joseph Smith thought of plural marriage in Nauvoo. And that's not something the scholars can help a great deal with, because we have so few records of contemporary plural marriage in Nauvoo. We have enough to be very sure of certain things, but they're not, for the most part, from Joseph Smith's point of view. And so we piece together his actions from later records and cannot have his own voice explaining in any detail what things were about.
Catherine M. Danes.
What we do have from Joseph Smith is section 132 in the Doctrine and Covenants. And that is not as clear-cut even as we would wish.
As we've seen before with Joseph Smith, he tended to keep sacred things to himself. And not unlike other significant revelations given to him in the past, Joseph Smith left no record of plural marriage beyond section 132, by which his actions and his motivations could later be explained or defended. Ronald K. Esplin.
Most of the records are not contemporaneous. They are later reminiscences of people who were close to Joseph Smith and who practiced plural marriage in Nauvoo.
So, for example, we have Joseph Smith's plural wives talking about their experiences, but they're doing it 20-some-odd years later, sometimes 40 years later. And as we know about memory, memory is not a file case where we just simply go in and we pull out exactly the way we thought at the time of the event.
These men and women give us a pretty good understanding of the landscape, but again, it leaves many interesting gaps, questions we'd like to answer that we cannot really answer. And principal among those is, why did Joseph Smith do what he did, when he did it, what did he have in his mind, how did he look upon some of the things that we find puzzling or even find concerning?
What we have in terms of documents from Nauvoo period are those from people who rejected plural marriage by and large. And so they're going to see things through their perspective, which naturally is going to be a distortion.
Now, as noted, the revelation that we know today as the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, it's all that exists from Joseph Smith explaining why plural marriage was revealed to him. And it wasn't written down until July of 1843. this lack of records has allowed some of Joseph Smith's detractors to accuse him of less than noble motives in restoring plural marriage. But in order for them to do that, they have to ignore the religious implications of the revelation he received.
Now, one of the interesting questions about plural marriage in Nauvoo is about the timing. The best we know, he understood from Revelation, as early as 1831-32, that plural marriage could be authorized by God and had been, of course, in some circumstances.
One of the easy answers that some scholars, and particularly those outside the church, have given for the introduction of plural marriage is simply lust, some sexual licentiousness. The record certainly doesn't support that.
Even those who have studied him later conclude, those who know Joseph well, including a friend of mine who's an anthropologist, whom I heard less than a year ago, talk about this. Joseph Smith, according to this anthropologist, was so immersed in his religion, I know that he went forward from a moral perspective. And if we don't understand what that is, it's our problem, not his, said this non-Mormon anthropologist.
Joseph Smith understandably recognized at the outset that introducing features of biblical polygamy in a monogamous culture would not be well received. Moreover, what few records do exist demonstrate that Joseph Smith was given no standardized form by which plural marriage was to be practiced.
When it came to Nauvoo, Joseph Smith faced a very difficult situation. From discussions in his own family, from reactions and the little efforts that they had made in 1830s, from common sense, Joseph Smith understood that if he were to introduce this, and he understood by now that it was his responsibility at some point to do this, it would likely divide the church, perhaps his own family, cause a great deal of difficulty and turmoil. And yet he felt that was his obligation. Among the sources that we have are several that I've run across which suggest that he told close associates to him that an angel came with a drawn sword and said, finally, it has to be now. You can't put it off any longer. These are reminiscent accounts. Again, we don't have Joseph's own voice. But we do know now from more recent research that up to 20 of these accounts survive. People that testify that they heard from Joseph that the angel had basically put him between a rock and a hard place. What would you do? Knowing that it may divide the church, that it would hurt their relationship with your wife, that it may cost you your life, but that it was your duty and your responsibility. Brigham Young reports that Joseph Smith more than once talked and thought about the cost. It may cost me my life, but if I have to die for any revelation that came through me, I would as lief it be this as any other, for it is true, is how Brigham Young remembered it.
So just introducing it within the church would be difficult. But then the larger American society, he knew, would reject the church's introducing this new practice.
Among those who struggled with plural marriage was Joseph's own brother, Hiram.
No one was closer and more supportive to Joseph than Hiram. Not just now, but throughout the 1830s, even back in the 20s when they were working on the Book of Mormon. But Hiram was so averse to the possibility that plural marriage might be revealed that he refused to listen.
Years afterward, Brigham Young spoke of a time in Nauvoo when he was assigned by Joseph Smith in a public meeting to respond to Hiram.
And Hiram spoke about plural marriage, about a context for resisting plural marriage or private teachings of this sort by holding up the scriptures and proclaiming these are the standard by which we live and slamming them on the table as the great guardian of our virtue and our understanding. During this whole thing, reports Brigham Young, Joseph Smith kept his head in his hands and just listened. And when Hiram sat down, he elbowed Brigham. Get up, it's your turn. And Brigham says, I got up and I picked up those same scriptures. And I said, these are indeed a great blessing and the word of God unto this people. but they are nothing compared to the living oracles of God. And he slammed them on the table. After the meeting, he says, Hiram came to him. I perceive the 12 know something that I do not know. And they were out in the woods where they could talk freely. They came to a full discussion, after which Hiram replied, I feared there was such a revelation, but I would not hear it. And he went off, prayed to the Lord, got his own understanding, went to his brother, got the authorized teaching, and thereafter became one of those who introduced authorized plural marriage in Nauvoo. But he took some months before he even was prepared to accept and to listen. Now, the case of Hiram is instructive because I know of no account of man or woman in Nauvoo who immediately embraced it as soon as they heard.
It was so against the tradition. It was so against everything that they had trained themselves to do, to be spiritually upright, do everything that they felt that God demanded of them, and then to be asked to do that, to do this, to go against what they had always believed heretofore. And so it took some very fervent prayer on the part of these people to accept it, and it was their own spiritual confirmation, not just their belief in Joseph Smith as a prophet, that led them to enter into plural marriage.
And perhaps no one had more of a faith crisis over plural marriage than Emma Smith.
We know from some women who were very close to her that she knew it was a revelation, that it wasn't Joseph Smith's invention.
Jeffrey O. Johnson.
Some of the brethren, William Clayton, said that she was very angry about it, and that Hiram, Joseph's brother, told Joseph that if Joseph would write down a revelation, he would take it to Emma and convince her that it was from God. And apparently, they wrote down the revelation. William Clayton wrote it. This is the one that is in our Doctrine and Covenants, section 132. The story goes that Emma burned it.
She continued to believe in him as a prophet to her death, believed he had the keys, that he restored the truth of the Book of Mormon and other great teachings. But, to use the word of one of them, Emma knew it was of God, but she could not abide it. And it was indeed difficult for everyone, and each woman, each man had to handle it in his or her own way. And in Emma's case, she could bring herself occasionally to embrace it for a day or two and rail against it in a day or two later, because she simply could not abide it.
In Nauvoo, the Mormons could not and did not preach, teach, or practice plural marriage openly. And this, of course, caused difficulty and misunderstanding.
Joseph Smith was introducing plural marriage to his tried and true loyal disciples. And they accepted plural marriage based on their faith in Joseph Smith and on their spiritual experiences. A number of these people, when they were first introduced to plural marriage, naturally rejected it. It was so outside of their traditions, so outside of their ideas, that they needed spiritual confirmation and did seek that spiritual confirmation, and that's what led them to accept plural marriage. But they knew that this could be difficult for the church, and so they were counseled to keep it secret.
Perhaps not surprisingly, some to whom the revelation was taught misused and perverted Joseph Smith's intent. Chief among those, John C. Bennett. His disaffection from the church and eventual excommunication were directly tied to this counterfeit practice. He called them spiritual wives, but it was nothing more than adultery.
So we did have, in fact, a great challenge to lay a foundation publicly for teaching about new revelation and new responsibilities and new doctrines about the temple, not just plural marriage, and at the same time to uphold morality and moral principles and try to close the door on the counterfeits, on the abuses and the misuses of this. at a great challenge, almost an impossible challenge. So when they denounced spiritual wifery, they were trying to denounce the abomination of the counterfeit while leaving still the door open for the private practice of authorized plural marriage. And therefore, it seems duplicitous, but it's another case of an effort of trying to do publicly what was probably impossible, that is, leave space for the authorized practice without encouraging the abuses.
Of course, there are still many questions about the practice of plural marriage that remain today because there's so few records. The saints practiced plural marriage for about 50 years, and through that time it proved to be a great challenge for them. And it remains even today a great challenge because there's so many questions that just can't be answered. It was not the only doctrine that Joseph Smith taught his people in Nauvoo that was difficult for them to accept. You'll remember that he felt a sense of urgency to move things along quickly, and accordingly, he pushed his people. He had to.
And Joseph talked at Nauvoo a good deal about the challenge of bringing new ideas to the saints. Even the saints are slow to understand. I bring a new idea and it breaks against you like glass. Bringing a new idea into the saints is like trying to split a hemlock knot with a corn dodger as a wedge and a pumpkin as a beetle. In other words, it cannot be done. So as he moves forward with some of these things that he feels are very important or responsibilities he has as the leader and prophetic steward of this dispensation, there are some casualties along the way, including some important leaders.
Nauvoo became, as Kirtland had been, a proving ground. And at the heart of it all was the question of prophetic leadership. Did the Latter-day Saints want a leader like a Moses who could speak for God at all times and in all matters? Or did they want something else?
Are we going to be a people under prophetic and priesthood leadership or not? And the tension, on the other hand, was about new doctrine and new teachings, plural marriage, plurality of gods, and other things that many were willing to understand, pray about, and eventually embrace, and which others never came to accept. Interestingly enough, they still loved Joseph. They still believed in the Book of Mormon. And so Nauvoo was a very complex place.
By 1844, mounting discord with non-Mormon antagonists in western Illinois, coupled with dissenters from within the Mormon ranks themselves, created a very volatile situation for the saints in Nauvoo. Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, we will look at those events that took Joseph and Hiram Smith to Carthage, Illinois, and to martyrdom. Next week, the climax of Nauvoo, Part 2. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.